And what happened in those 5 minutes went far beyond what any of us had expected. So I had, for all my events, I do risk assessments and contingencies for things not working to plan. However, sometimes, like this occasion, things go far beyond what I had anticipated, and I have to react in the moment to make provisions for higher emotions than I had expected. So people started crying, people started saying they would leave their partners. I'm very sorry to anyone if that did happen. People said they were going to buy a ticket for New York immediately to go and do this particular thing. People were going to speak to their parents. So I ended up becoming a pseudo therapist to receive people as they came out, and I had to create a suddenly an extra area to help land people because of the high state of emotions and thoughts that had come about for them. And then about a month later, we posted the letters to them so that it was unexpected when they received it.
Welcome to season 4 of Go Out and Talk to Strangers. This is Adi. I'm a nomadic architect and the founder of The New Movement, an architectural design studio that designs one-of-a-kind, innovative, and creative projects worldwide, using the built environment as a tool to help people thrive. During my travels, I am constantly meeting incredible people, people who are reshaping the way we live, work, and connect. The reason I started this show is because I want to highlight the ones who are leading the way. This is the place where I host thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and founders of unique projects to share their stories and insights. I want to invite you to be part of the change. If you're looking for something bigger than yourself, if you also feel that we can do better and standard is simply not good enough, you're in the right place. I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. Today, we're going to talk about designing emotions with the brilliant Pigal Tavakoli. Pigal is an experienced designer with 15 years' expertise producing immersive experiences, installations, and programs for organizations such as the Victoria and Albert Museum, Science Museum, Barbican Center, National Portrait Gallery, and many more. She specializes in multidisciplinary approach, combining the arts and science, and develop cross-platform story worlds, which merge the physical and digital. Since 2012, she co-developed and teaches the UK first short course in experience design at the University of Arts London. And now she founded the School of Experience Design to empower others to create high-impact experiences. We will dive deep into the world of experience design, walk through the methods and processes Pigal uses in her work and teachings, and gain a better understanding of the experience design world, mindset, and how to implement those concepts to any idea you want to bring to the world. So, let's begin. I'm very, very excited to welcome to the show Pigal. Hi, Pigal.
Hi, Eddie. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm just as excited to join you.
Me too. It's been a while that I wanted to have you on the show, and I'm super excited that we finally get the chance to talk. So first of all, how are you today, Pigal?
I'm feeling great. I'm actually joining you from Berlin, and we have had our summer starting. So I am overjoyed to have the sunshine out, and it's a wonderful atmosphere on the streets.
Amazing. Oh, summer in Berlin. This is really lovely. I'm today in Lisbon. It's sunny and lovely, just the way Lisbon can be.
Lisbon's beautiful. Lisbon's really beautiful. Yeah, it's a fantastic city.
It is. It is. And we're just about to celebrate Santos, which is our holiday. So it's going to be quite festive outside in a few days. So let's dive in. What is experience design for people who are not familiar with it?
I have to laugh because it really is the million-dollar question. And no matter the explanation I give, there's probably a million other explanations for it as well, which is part of the beauty and the joy and the complexity of it as well. So I like to say, before I give my explanation, I like to say that it's a wonderful field where there are many, many perspectives to it. So it's like having a big jewel, which has lots of facets and sides to it. And it's absolutely wonderful to hear all the different perspectives that are part of describing what experience design is. So the world is big enough to encompass all these different views. So I will share with you my particular take on it. So the first thing I would say is that I consider experience design to be more than just a design discipline. The way that I view it is as an approach, a way of thinking, and a mindset. And I actually consider it on a much more philosophical level, as something through which we view the way we live and experience our lives. And then the way we live and experience our lives then plays into the way we decide to design experiences and create impact for others. So I view it in a much more holistic, philosophical approach rather than specifically a design discipline. And because I have that view on it, it means that from my perspective, people can study, learn, produce experiences, and then that forms their foundation from which they can then study all the other design disciplines and be able to use everything they've learned from experience design, no matter which design discipline they're coming from. And I know that works because for the last 10 years, I've been teaching experience design and developed methods, frameworks, and a process. And on the courses that I teach, I have people from all design disciplines coming, people who don't even come from the design world, who are artists, curators, people from government, people from brand agencies, people from all sorts of areas and walks of life. And each person individually can take the set of methods, tools, process, and they can find that it's immediately applicable to their particular design discipline. And what it helps them to do is to think deeper about what they're doing and why they're doing it. What's the intention behind what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what is that long-term impact and transformation they are looking to bring about. Now, none of that has actually yet given you my explanation of experience
I know
design.
you're just teasing us. The disclaimer. Okay, we got it. There are a million ways to define it, but I want to hear yours because you've been doing that for a while and from many different angles.
So, I recently was asked to describe what experience design is, being only allowed to choose three words. And actually, that was quite useful because as you can hear, I could spend a long time explaining it. So, I think I will go back to that because, yes, so I would use three words to try and encompass what experience design is. So the three words are experience, internal world, and transformation. So what I mean by each of these words is the way I describe what an experience is that especially in the design world, we're very preoccupied with designing everything that takes place outside of us or outside of our audience or consumer or user. Now, those are all external elements that we're using, and usually the design stops at that point. It designs everything on the outside and then the job is finished. However,
Okay.
when the audience interacts with the outside elements, there's a magical alchemical moment that happens when the outside external elements enter into the audience. And there's this wonderful reaction and internal changes that take place. So that moment of alchemical reaction, I call an experience. An experience is when the audience has internal changes within them. And I like to say that there are three types of internal changes we can design for during these experiences. So we can design to the way the audience feels, we can design to change the way they think, and then ultimately the way they behave. So the word experience in experience design is about using the external elements, designing the external elements as our tools in order to achieve the aim of internal experience. So that helps to describe experience and internal versus external. Mm-hmm. And so the third step, thank you, and the third step of this alchemical reaction is what takes place long after the interaction, the external interaction, the internal changes, what takes place long afterwards. So in alchemy, it was a belief system and an approach which considered taking a material, and through a reaction it would then transmute into another state. So I like to compare the internal changes of experience design similar to alchemy, because the audience arrives and arrive in an original state that they are currently in, and through the process of their interaction of the event, the activity, the external elements, they have this alchemical internal reaction and changes, which means when they leave the event, activity or experience, long afterwards they continue to transmute and change into another state. They are no longer the same as when they first came. So for me, experience design starts first by considering what is that long-term impact and transformation we want to bring about. And then we work backwards in the design process in order to eventually decide what are the tools that will help to bring that about. So that's why I think of it as this holistic approach, because it's not just focused on the moment of the event, activity or these external elements. It designs the whole journey, which carries on long afterwards. So I hope that's helped to shine a light.
That's wonderful. No, that absolutely helps. So what I'm hearing from what you're saying is that this approach helps people to be more intentional about why they're doing this thing. Why do we create this event, this experience, this art installation? What is the long-term effect that we want to achieve? And then go backwards from there, like you just said. And it's interesting because I think I'm also an experienced designer myself, a beginner, I'd say. And for many people who are not familiar with this area, they'll think it's some sort of a UX skill, which is actually, again, kind of true, but not really. So we do that in marketing all the time. We navigate the emotions and the journey of the visitor on the website or the supermarket. And we have strategy for shelving and, layout, and how can we get people to spend more? So they are quite aware of what is the long-term effect or what is the immediate effect that they want to have in the space. But then when we come to buildings, for example, it's quite rarely used in residential living or in even in hospitality when people have the best intentions and they're creating the most extraordinary projects. They don't go step by step with what is the journey of the human who's about to enter this space. How does it start from the moment they book the stay, when they get back home and process whatever they experience during that stay? And I know that you developed some tools and methods to help people do that.
Absolutely. And I really love everything that you've described. There are actually quite many points there I could touch on. I think maybe first.
Let's do that.
Yeah. So I think first, the why is really important. So when people actually manage to think about why they're designing an experience, that's already a huge milestone, because as you've just explained, many people don't even get to that stage. With the why, usually people consider the why to be what the aims and outputs that are listed in the creative brief, which is usually increase audience, increase engagement, and most likely increase sales. However, those aren't necessarily the deeper why. So in experience design, we use those factors, but we dig deeper in order to find out the deeper why. And the deeper why would be, what is the long-term impact and ultimate transformation that we can bring about? So the two parts to asking why is, why am I designing this? And even more importantly, why should anyone care? And I think people forget the second bit, which I'd love to touch on, you mentioning the word humans, because I really dislike the word user and customer. And I know these are industry jargonistic words, and that's the way we need to speak to our, you know, to the people that we're working with. However, I would love to help contribute to humanizing the language we use, because we are dealing with people, with human beings, in all of their glorious, messy, complexity, richness, poetry, individual needs and motivations.
Oh, yeah.
And so experience design is essentially a human-centered approach, which starts the whole design process by doing deep examination into who the audience is and going beyond external data and demographics, taking that on board, but digging far deeper into psychographics so that we can really uncover and get to understand the deeper motivations of the audience, because then we want to design transformation to reach those deeper motivations. And then
I do have a question. Well, I want to stop you there, because this is wonderful, but I want to help people imagine. So what does it mean, psychographic? Like, how do you do that? How do you decide who is going to show up for this experience, and how to crack what ticks them?
Yeah, it's a great question. Normally, when people are doing a project or a commission, they are usually issued with a creative brief. And on the creative brief, the client will have said who their target audience is. And they will put a few sentences about their understanding of that audience. And because it's a creative brief, everything is brief. As experienced designers, it's too brief. There isn't actually enough information for us to go beyond our presumptions, assumptions, prejudices. So we like to take from the creative brief the few sentences which have been provided about the audience, and then carry out more in-depth audience research. And I always recommend doing a range of methods, not sticking to one, because different methods give you different insights about your audience. And what you're trying to do is remove yourself from the equation. So traditionally in design, it's about the designer imprinting their vision on the design for the public or the audience to use. And in experience design, we as the designers want to become invisible. What we're trying to do is create something which speaks directly and connects to the audience so that they have ownership over it. They create meaningful connections, emotional journeys, and long-term memories with the experience. So we always have to keep reminding ourselves the design isn't about us, what we like, what we don't like, the latest technology that we're really excited to try out. It's about our audience and understanding their needs and their deeper motivations.
Oh my.
So
I can't relate more. Sometimes as an architect, I have people asking me, what's your signature style? How can I even have a signature style other than deep listening? Because each project is in a different continent for a different culture with different materials. Who am I to impose my signature style into something? That's such a weird question when you think about it. And I just love what you said with this approach of being invisible, being of service to the humans who are going to come to this experience and hopefully take something with them to the next days back home or whatever they're going to next. I have so many questions for you.
And can I reflect back on what Please. You've just said? Because I absolutely love that you said if you had a signature style, it would be deep listening. Mm. And I just want to applaud you for that, because it's about time people considered this. And I think the idea of a signature style is from an old paradigm. It's from a previous structure, previous cultural approach to design. My original background is in theatre and a decade in fashion, and I was a fashion designer. So even as a fashion designer, I turned it on its head. I didn't want to have a signature style, which is still traditional in fashion. I wanted to create styles which empowered the women as people who were wearing them and helped to celebrate them individually in the fullness of their potential. So coming,
wow, I want to see moving
it. So moving into events and experiences, it just became a natural progression of my approach, which was, instead of empowering individual women, I could help to empower everyone.
Yes.
And like create a total experience, not just what they're wearing, and really allow them to become the protagonists, the leaders in their own story, in their own experience, in their own learnings. Because it's really only then that people will change and transform long afterwards. Because also in design, we're all guilty of also assuming we can change people, and we can't. We really can't. And if we could start to admit that to ourselves, because people only really change long term if they want to, and they are the architects of their own change. They are the doers of their own change. So what we can do is help facilitate the conditions, the tools, the elements, the event, the product, to provide them with a situation or a tool which then encourages them to become the people who want to make the changes, so that they can go on to make those changes afterwards. We can absolutely create changes in the short term, and that's where things like behavioral science, herd economics, nudge theory, they do create changes. However, I would argue they create changes by coercion, manipulation, and various other unclear means to the audience. And I would argue that those changes aren't long term, because the people didn't make those changes of their own volition and in a way which they fully wish to continue implementing them in their lives. So those kind of like changes that come from nudge and coercion tend to not last beyond the nudge. Once the nudge is removed, people tend to flip back to the way they did it before.
So when we're talking about experiences, what would you say the connection is between an experience and a memory and how those transform our lives? Keep in mind that many of the listeners of this podcast, they're not creating experiences. They do create experiences, but long-term ones. And how might we help them to create better spaces, projects, communities? So I would love to hear from you on that.
It's an excellent question. And one which I'm very passionate about as well. So there are several steps along the journey for an experience to become memorable. And the key link between an experience and memories is emotions. So when I describe an experience as an internal reaction and changes that goes through an audience, one of those internal changes is changes in their emotions. Now, emotions are the most powerful internal changes we can design for. And there's a scientific reason for this. So for those of us that love geeking out on neuroscience and brain anatomy, which I love, bring on the scientists.
Yes, please.
And yes. I've been very, very fortunate in my career for 15 years to work with incredible scientists. So actually working with them, I've been in the unique position to learn their scientific theories and latest research and actually then transpose it and connect the dots with experience design and my theories. So as a multidisciplinary specialist, I'm always trying to connect the dots between disciplines. So what I learned on my journey with scientists and their research is within the brain, we have I'm going to oversimplify it, so please forgive me, scientists, with the oversimplification, because the brain is incredibly complex and there are many areas, but I'm just going to talk about two key areas for us. Okay. So the front part of our brain is known as the prefrontal cortex. So this is where our forehead is. We can all our listeners can touch their fronts of their heads and they're actually getting a sense of their prefrontal cortex. Now, the thing about the prefrontal cortex is when we have language and data-driven information that comes to us, we receive it going directly into the prefrontal cortex of our brain. However, when we have emotionally rich information that comes in, it completely bypasses our frontal cortex and we have no control over doing that. It goes straight to the center back of our brains, to a wonderful area, a small area called the amygdala. And the amygdala is where emotions are processed. Now, the amygdala sits next to another wonderful little part called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is where memories are processed. Now, because the amygdala and the hippocampus live close together, they have a symbiotic relationship together. So when emotionally charged information comes in, completely bypasses our rational thinking, logical forms of thinking, it goes straight into our amygdala and activates our emotions. Now, our emotions speak to the hippocampus to retrieve past memories and experiences to inform how we will react to this situation or experience or product. And that will then, the memories will then inform the emotions, how the emotions should feel. At the same time, the emotions which we start to feel, so it sends signals to our bodies and our muscles, on our response, physical response to the emotions. At the same time, we start to form memories of the emotions we are producing in that moment. So if we want to create experiences or products or buildings or other types of experiences which are memorable, then we want to make them highly emotionally charged, because it's the emotions that will form those unforgettable memories. And every time people think back to that experience, the same emotions will come flooding back and they will start to have the same physiological responses to them. Amazing. So that's my whistle stop tour of the brain.
I love it. So, okay, let's say someone is interested in doing that. How do you create an emotionally charged moment or spaces or experiences?
So I would say there are step by steps to go through in the design process for that. And the very first step is don't think of ideas, which is always counterintuitive for designers and artists and people who create things. So the hardest thing is not to come up with ideas first. I always say, and this is an extremely important aspect of experience design, you start by first considering your audience and doing a deep level of, as you do, listening, a deep level of listening, empathy, mapping, psychographic research, and you collect all of that research together to allow insights to emerge. Our challenge as a designer is to step out of the way, to not allow our own preconceptions, assumptions, desires, wishes to muddy the waters, because if we let the audience talk to us, they reveal incredible clues, insights. And once we allow those to emerge, those clues and insights start to give us indications of what the design might encompass. Then we can move to the next stage, which is clarifying the long-term aims and impact that we want to bring about. So now we understand audience motivations. What is the long-term impact we want to create in order to fulfill those motivations? And once we got the two sides of that coin figured out, at that point we can start the ideation process, and they become our touchstones to keep us on track to then consider, okay, if these deeper motivations and long-term transformation are our goals, what sorts of emotions do we want to evoke in the audience which could bring that about? So you're still not thinking about ideas. You're still and then once you've got the emotions you want to bring about, you could also consider what kind of thoughts, what kind of perspectives or mind shifts do we want to bring about? And then finally, you think about what kind of behavior changes are we trying to bring about? And they give you a really fantastic framework within which to then ideate and come up with lots of amazing ideas. However, the ideas have a strategic focus, and the focus is always the audience. It's not about us, it's about them, and it's about that transformation. So we create this wonderful framework from which to then ideate.
This is absolutely wonderful, and thank you so much for sharing it. And I think it would be useful if you can just briefly share a case study or a process that you've been to with a client to understand what are some of the insights that you had not anticipated in the first phase, and then how did you use those insights in designing the experience itself. I'm also going to throw it here because I know we're almost starting to come to an end and I don't want this to end, so we might go longer if that's okay with you. I'm also quite curious to see how this could be measured. So if you can also think of a brief case study where we can see how that comes in action.
Yes, let's make this tangible.
Okay.
As you can hear, I'm a deep thinker.
I see that. I'm grateful for However, it. We need the book. Are you writing the book already or is it coming soon?
It's years in the making.
Okay, good. Do let me know when it's there.
I will.
I think so many people are going to benefit with it. But just to be able to have this conversation with you now, it's already a great start. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
And yeah, thank you. Stage is yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as well as being a deep thinker, I'm also a doer. I like to say I walked the walk before I talked the talk. So as a producer for 15 years, I am all about having great ideas, but even more importantly, make them happen. So the thinking came later when I started teaching 10 years ago. So I think it's really good that I walked the walk before talking the talk.
Yeah.
So let's make this more tangible for our wonderful listeners here today. So a very common situation I'm presented with is a client on the creative brief, when they say who they want their target audience to be, they often say, everybody.
Yes, this is so common. Why not, right? Because we like all humans, they're all invited here.
Yeah,
yeah.
They want everyone. So my job as an experience designer and skill and craft is the art of negotiation, diplomacy, and gaining buy-in at every stage of the way. So I have to be able to discuss with the client, to ask them further questions, to dig down a bit further into this whole audience of everyone and start to drill down into, okay, if we had everyone, who they might consider as being the most important audience, which would become primary audience, who would be become the secondary and the tertiary audiences. So I sort of guide them through a process of really refining it into a primary and secondary audience. And ideally, I would design an experience for one or two audiences. Once it's more than that, I then recommend to the client we design separate experiences for each of the audience, because I can't wave a magic wand. I'm here to break the news to us all. It's extremely difficult, near on impossible, to create one experience which will impact everyone in the same way. It's really not really that feasible. It's much better to focus in on a particular audience so you can really gain understandings of them, to design an experience that's really targeted for them, to connect meaningfully. So that's the first thing. I usually have to help the client to realize there's a primary audience which is of high value for them to reach.
Who is that primary audience in the example that we're going to talk about?
Yes, so I'm just trying to think of a really good example where we shifted from everybody to a specific audience. Since that has been every case in point, usually. I think I'm going to choose a wonderful case study which I have shared in other talks, because it broke a lot of rules of how I usually work.
Okay.
And it creates quite a few thought provocations. So there was a brief that I had, which was for a museum and science culture center called the Wellcome Collection in London on Euston Road, and they were having an exhibition on death. And they wanted an event to be created for the public so that they could become excited to come to this exhibition on the culture, on how death is being treated in different cultures across the world. So the first thing we said to them is they had a very packed program. They had a lot of other people they were commissioning, and we looked at that. So we said to them, well, we don't want to design this experience for everyone that's coming, because for the launch of the exhibition, they were expecting quite a few thousand people. So we said, actually, we don't want to design something for 2,000 people. Death is a very personal, vulnerable, intimate subject for people. So we would like to make it a very personal, individual, intimate experience. And therefore, we don't want to do it for everyone. So that was the first thing we said to them. So we said we would like to actually do it for only a few people at where they get 5 minutes each. And it's a one-to-one intimate experience. So instead of thousands, and normally I do create experience for thousands as well, but for this, we wanted to go the opposite way. And so in order to not disappoint the thousands of people coming, because we calculated only 30 people could take part, we also said counterintuitively, please don't put us in the program. We want to be secret. We want to be a Ooh. Secret experience where we...
Oh, I love secret experiences.
That was the reaction we wanted.
Yeah.
So rather than disappointment that they turn up and can't get in, we had a role, we trained an actor as a role player to mix with the thousands of people and approach certain people and give them a card. And the card had a quote and an invitation, if they dared, to find this secret experience. And it had an instructions where to find it. And we calculated that some people would do it, some people wouldn't. So anyway, the people that did came through, and then the experience itself was, we'd created an environment, and in that environment, it was just them and another role-playing actor. And the actor had a typewriter, a vintage typewriter in front of them. And they asked the person, if this was your last moment on Earth, what would be your unfulfilled ambition or dream? You have 5 minutes to share that with me. And then they turned a sand timer for the 5 minutes. And then they kept completely silent and did what you do. They did active listening. And they just gave the 5 minutes over to the other person to say anything that they wished to say in response to that question. And then the actor typed their responses out. At the end of it, the actor then gave them what had been typewritten and said to them, this is a letter to yourself. If you could please read it to check that you're happy and sign it, and then you will receive this in the post when you least expect it and when you most need it. And
wow.
And what happened in those 5 minutes went far beyond what any of us had expected. So I had, for all my events, I do risk assessments and contingencies for things not working to plan. However, sometimes, like this occasion, things go far beyond what I had anticipated, and I have to react in the moment to make provisions for higher emotions than I had expected. So people started crying, people started saying they would leave their partners, I'm very sorry to anyone if that did happen. People said they were going to buy a ticket for New York immediately to go and do this particular thing. People were going to speak to their parents. So I ended up becoming a pseudo therapist to receive people as they came out. And I had to create a suddenly an extra area to help land people because of the high state of emotions and thoughts that had come about for them. And then about a month later, we posted the letters to them so that it was unexpected when they received it. So this comes to the tracking and measuring. This segues nicely into tracking and measuring impact.
Well done. Well done. Well, first of all, I want to, okay, please finish with the measuring, and then I want to respond because that meets me in a very special point in time.
Okay, thank you.
I'll share in a bit.
Thank you. So during the experience, and we've actually got a video recording with somebody saying on camera how it changes their life forever. And immediately after the experience, I had people coming back to tell me that they can't stop thinking about what's occurred for them. And we repeated this at a festival as well, and we had exactly the same reactions take place. So we were able to track and make studies and capture responses and data and information during and immediately after the experience for the time that we were on site. Now, in terms of long term, I had invited several people to take part in the experience if they were willing to take part in a long-term survey and to then give us their honest reactions when we asked them in a long time to come. But I didn't want to specify the time because I didn't want them to know when the letters would arrive as well.
Yeah. And so you had people agreeing to that?
Yes. So we did collect a number of people who would be willing to be part of a long-term survey. And so about 3 months later, we contacted them to ask them about their responses to their memories of what took place, what they've retained personally to them and any effect that's had in their lives, and then about the letter and then how that has continued to resonate and create changes that they implemented in their lives. And then by chance, I had a response that I discovered 10 years later. And this is amazing. Wow. So, so this is absolutely amazing. I love this. I went to see a friend. I now live in Berlin. I used to live in London. I now live in Berlin and I globetrot everywhere else in between. And in Berlin, I have a friend from London who moved to live in Berlin and has been living here for many years. And I went to his house and his front door, as I was about to leave, he has a gilt, antique gilt frame just beside his front door. And then inside it, he has a little card, which is a bit worn out and a bit tatty, and it's just stuck on the wall. And I said to him, and on the card, it says, "Seize the day." And I said to him, "This is really unusual. You've got this tatty card, and yet you've put this wonderful, beautiful gold gilt frame around it. Where did you get it from? What is this?" And he turned to look at me and he said, "Pigal, this is from your experience." And I was like, "Which experience?" I absolutely had no recollection of this card. I really didn't know what he meant. And this was one of the cards that we had handed out to the audience to invite them to come to the secret experience. And we had put lots of different sayings on them. And I'd long forgotten what those sayings are. And I had assumed that people would throw that away and not keep it anymore. But what he remembered wasn't the experience. His main memory is this card. So at the time he lived in London, and when he got this card, it made him think about how he wished he could be braver with the decisions he makes in his life. And then several years later, he met a German girl, fell in love, and then at some point in the long distance relationship, looked at the card and thought, "I should seize the day and go for it and make the move to Berlin." He moved to Berlin, and then many years later, the relationship went their separate ways. However, he's kept it by his front door so that every day he thinks about being bold and making those brave choices. So I feel blessed that 10 years later, I was lucky enough to find out that he is still continuing the transformation for himself. And it taught me a very important lesson, which is we don't know which aspect in our experience is going to have that profound impact for people. And it's really important that every single aspect we design with care and intention. And just to trust that one of those aspects will create this meaningful connection with someone and will become it will cause the spark for that alchemical reaction to take place.
Woo! I just want to... Wow, that was so, 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 so beautiful. I can totally see how that could happen, right? Also, when dealing with death, which is such a powerful subject and inevitable end for all of us. Just a few days ago, I was in a living funeral ceremony facilitated by Oceana Sawyer. So this is very much aligned with my own experience. And that was amazing to see the whole setting. And I don't want to go too much into detail because this is not our focus here. But one thing that was interesting, she says, because she's been doing that for a while, and she got us to promise that we're not going to make any radical changes in our lives in the 48 hours after the experience, because it was really profound and so beautiful and emotional and interesting to see that as a group. We were, 30 people. Very interesting. Yeah, we can talk more about it later. Because now I want to, so there are two more questions that I have to ask you before we end. Like, it's not a, it's, I can't move on without it. So one of them would be, if you had to give advice to someone who's just now starting a project and want to have those impactful moments, what would you advise them to do? And the second one, we'll get to it later.
Okay, it would be remiss of me at some point not to mention a life-changing book that I read many years ago, which put me on the path to experience design. So if somebody is interested in designing experience, the first thing I always say to them is go and read The Experience Economy by Joseph Pine and James Gilmore. Many people say that there are groundbreaking books. Many people say there are pioneering authors. I would say that Joe Pine and James Gilmore can really lay claim to that title because they wrote that book decades before people started to wake up to the importance and value of what they were championing. And I am absolutely delighted to be part of the wave of new thinkers and doers which they activated through their incredible work and the amazing work they continue to do. So I always say the Bible of experience design is The Experience Economy. The second thing I say to people is go and live life. If you want to design transformative experiences, then you need to embrace the fullness of life and lean into all the richness of experiences it can offer you. And that means both positive and challenging, because life in its fullness is all shapes, sizes, and colors and nuances. And the more that we experience in our lives, the more we're able to understand about creating those types of experiences for others. So those are my two top pieces of advice.
Wonderful. Thank you. Really good advices. And I have to say, as one who is living the second advice, there's nothing I recommend more than just being active in, you know, embracing different experiences and places and cultures. It's just so enriching. Well, we are really over time and we're coming to an end. So I want to thank you for coming here today. And I want to ask you, where is the best place, before I ask you the last final question, where is the best place that our listeners can connect with you?
Oh, fantastic. Oh my God, it's been amazing to speak with you as well. And I really love your approach. And you are absolutely an experienced designer. There's no need to say beginner, intermediate, it's none of that. It's an approach, it's a mindset, and it's a way of being and living. And you're already doing that. You already are an experienced designer. Please do say it with pride. And many of the listeners here are already experienced designers. Hopefully the things I've said have resonated and they can relate to and helps them to realize they are already doing it. They just haven't used the words to explain that. So yes, I just wanted to mention that. And then I have lost the thread of your wonderful question.
Where is the best place to connect with you?
Oh, yes.
Or to follow your work or interesting thoughts? Because this is clearly not enough.
Yes, and as you can see, I love to talk. I love to listen and I also love to talk. Yes, people, you're lovely listeners can connect with me on LinkedIn, Pigal Tavakoli, and they can come and take a look at my school, my online school, which is the schoolofexperiencedesign.net. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I take part in lots of seminars and conferences, wonderful podcasts like yourselves, contribute to articles. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about this topic.
Wonderful. And I'm going to make sure that the links to everything you just mentioned is going to be in the show notes. So now we're going to move into the last question, which is called the wild napkin.
Exciting. I'm excited.
It's a very fun question. So you're going to a bar and you have a couple of drinks and your mind is really free. And all of a sudden you have the craziest idea, but all you have is a napkin. So you write it down. The next day you find it. What does it say?
I'm going to quote John Lennon. On that napkin, I would write, imagine if all the people could be living in harmony and peace.
That's the wildest idea. That's so cute.
Well, unbelievably, it is the wildest thing for us to achieve. Which is why it immediately came to mind. It's the simplest thing of all, and yet, crazily enough, the hardest thing for us all to achieve. And hopefully, I'm just playing my own small part with experience design and all the other practitioners like yourself and the people listening in. We're all just playing our own small part to hopefully help all of that to come about.
I love that. So I see that your why, your always practicing your method, I can tell. So that's your why. But then there is an unlimited budget and really no time stress. How would you do something that brings us one step closer to that reality? I'm going to challenge you a bit. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I love being challenged. Bring it on. So this helps me to mention that budget is not really the element that affects the quality or impact of a design. And it feeds into what I just quoted from the wonderful John Lennon, because the most powerful thing that we can actually evoke in others is their imagination. So we can use one tool or 57 tools. The main thing is people's imagination is richer than anything we could use. So I think I'll go back to simplicity, because I have done events and experiences with 57 tools. And I think my 5-minute one-to-one experience taught me a lot about this, actually boiling something down to its essence. So maybe what I would do then, thinking off the top of my head, is in that bar, I would take a bunch of napkins and some pens, and I would write on it, imagine if you could dot, dot, dot. And then I would place a napkin and a pen on each of the tables. And then I'd wait to see what would happen. So that's just me making it up on the fly. I wouldn't normally do that. I would normally be quite strict and say, no, we should follow the process, follow the G's, each step, each of the way. But that's just me.
No, that's beautiful. And thank you.
Responding to your challenge.
Thank you for doing that so openly. So basically you're creating a ripple effect of my question.
Hopefully.
Which I find myself asking quite often with people I meet on my travels. Like, you know, if money and time wasn't an issue, what would you do? And then sometimes I'll receive emails or messages on Instagram saying, you know, that conversation we had, I decided to shift this and that. And now I'm doing what I actually want to do because I never thought that's possible for me. It's sometimes such a simple question.
And the thing is, people often feel that time and budget are the constraints to their ideas. And I would say, actually, having limited time and limited budget is fantastic practice for us, because it means as designers, we have to use our imagination even more. So it helps us to push beyond the most obvious solution or idea or design and actually have to be smarter with what we use and be more creative of how we use them to create the same impact. So I actually say to people, forget time and money. That's not the problem. We hold the key, and that key lies within us, and that's our imagination, both as designers and activating the imagination of the audience.
Bravo. I love it. Thank you so much for being here with us today and for sharing all your beautiful thoughts with us. And until the next time, go out and talk to strangers. Bye, everyone. Have a great day.
Bye.